air, and it's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor. A special good morning to all those feeling victimized by everything around them. I want to say hi to the victims. Hello, Mark Riley.
Good morning, Mark Merritt. And you know who you should say a special good morning to?
Sacramento.
Sacramento is one place, yes.
Sacramento needs attention.
Sacramento, what up?
Good morning, Sacramento.
But you know who else you should say good morning to? Lawton Smalls.
Lawton Smalls.
Who didn't think he'd hear you again on these airwaves.
Oh, really?
He was. Lawton called from Planet Bush last week and said Marin was done.
I'm not done. I'm back. How are you doing, buddy?
I'm doing all right, man. I missed you.
I bet you did.
Come on, man. Look, we had Mick, we had Laura, we had Ellis, we had Ted. They were all great, but I missed the Marin touch.
Thank you, my friend.
I'm a Marinite, just like in Lebanon.
Here I thought I'd go away and nobody would want me anymore. But no, there's at least two or three of you out there that might have missed me. Kalo, I get back. I'm all excited to see Kalo, but apparently this is not a Kalo day. Kalo has had his wisdom teeth out. He's strung out on Vicodin. He's not looking happy. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, man.
I'm sorry, man. I'm sorry about your face, dude.
I'm sorry.
Look, and if it were another time, you know what I'd be saying?
What's that?
Hey, you got any more Vicodin? How many you got? If it were a different point in my life,
I do have like 20 more.
You have 20 more with
you?
We could have a party.
How much?
I'm thinking about relapse for the anniversary. That's right, Friday, for 1 year anniversary of Morning Sedition. Hey, dude, what's up?
Got any?
I'm all right, man. Yeah. So what do we got going?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, man. This is cool. I can't eat.
That's
Friday, man. The Vicodin show of Morning Sedition. So I was in the... I took my vacation, Riley.
You were in Los Angeles.
I went to my home in Los Angeles for the time being. It was basically a lot of... it was a lot of lovemaking, a lot of food, a lot of movies. There were some cat issues. You know, I'm touching base with my wife's gardening efforts. My wife, I have found, has a compulsive gardening problem.
What is it? I mean, she's got a green thumb, right?
She's real good, man. And she just has made all these gardens all around the property. But I get out. She wakes up in the morning. She gets some coffee. She goes out into the back to have a cigarette. The next thing, I'm like, Mishna, what's going on? She's sawing. She's got a pruning. One of those pruning. You know, one of those things that you. It's about 20 feet up, and there's a saw in it. She's taking pieces of the tree down. She's in her bathrobe out there. I don't know what it is, but if that's how she burns off steam, it looks nice. You know what I mean? It's one of those productive, compulsive things.
Oh, yeah, man. And see, the thing is, you'd be surprised how people go off on gardening. Mm-hmm. I tend not to, as long as it's not overgrown with weeds, it's wonderful. But, people, when they get into serious gardening, pruning stuff, when it looks like it's getting ready to grow.
Oh, she's all about that. She's got plants coming in, sprouts coming in from around the world to plant. And she's very into the succulents, into the regional, foliage of the L.A. area. She took me up into the San Gabriel Mountains.
That's by Pasadena, right?
Yeah, it's huge. It's a huge national park. We're going on a hike, and she's just walking around going, this thing probably doesn't need any water at all. Look at the little seeds on this. I'm like, oh, my God, when did you become Yule Gibbons?
Were you home? No, you were on your way back yesterday, right?
Yeah.
I was curious because I know you live in a predominantly Mexican neighborhood.
Yes,
right?
I do.
Well, the Mexicans beat the Americans in soccer yesterday, so I'm figuring that there was a lot of celebration.
I don't know. I left pretty early. I didn't hear it. I didn't know what.
No, that was later on in the day.
I missed all that. But what did I do when I was in Los Angeles? I didn't do any comedy. Went and saw my wife perform a couple times. Saw a few movies. Went and saw Downfall about Hitler in the bunker during the fall of Berlin. Brilliant movie. Must-see movie.
Really?
Overwhelming. The only problem is that, you never want to hear yourself saying this in the middle of a movie. Oh, poor Hitler.
You don't want to be saying here.
That's the weird thing about this movie. It's such an intimate sort of portrait of what was going on in the bunker at the time of the fall of Berlin. It really humanizes a guy in a way that he's still, disturbing, horrendous, fascist dictator responsible for killing millions of people. But you do see in this portrait of him, it's performed by Bruno Ganz, who I think is a brilliant actor, has been in a lot of Wim Wenders movies, is you do see a person as opposed to, this sort of mythic being. being, and it's just insane what went on in there. And also, there's certain similarities between sort of ideological commitment and loyalty that you see or you sense you see in this government here. You know, obviously, no one's going to, you know, in America, they don't kill themselves. They just sort of make sure that they're protected politically somehow and can go on with their careers. But all these guys, their commitment to Hitler and their commitment to Nazism was, like, disturbing for you know, a lot of reasons, but that so many of them just blew their brains out in the bunker because they saw no other way out. It was ideologically the appropriate thing to do. If Germany was lost to the Nazis, then all life was lost. And these guys were blowing their brains out left and right. It was a mind-blowing movie. It was so disturbing in so many ways. But politically, I think it has resonance in terms of what's going on now and the type of commitment that you see in fascism and also you see in line of like the Christo fascist zombie brigades right now. The type of commitment that you saw during fascist Germany is similar to what you see now.
Well, you know, apparently a lot of those German generals were scared to death because the Russians were coming into Berlin when all this was going on.
Right.
And I think a lot of them were scared to death of being captured by the Russians. But I saw a documentary on the last days of Hitler, and apparently there's like a basketball court on top of the entrance to the bunker where all of these people ended up ending their lives. There's no marker. There's no, you know, there's
nothing.
There
was just a door. Yeah, there was just a door. And I saw that same documentary because they had the full plans of the bunker. They knew exactly where everything was. And the woman that this story was loosely based on was a woman who applied to be Hitler's secretary during that time. And she apparently lived, until like the year 2002 or something. And a lot of this was drawn from her recollection. But the woman who played Eva Braun and some of the other characters within it, and I think it was pretty historically accurate. It was just the weird, frenetic kind of, you know, doom that was, you know, they knew the jig was up, and they were down in this hole, you know, trying to act like everything was, you know, and to see Hitler in this delusional state, still thinking that he could win the war, I'd never seen anything like this movie. I grew up a Jew seeing, you know, nothing. Yeah. I saw nothing but Nazis plowing corpses into holes, you know, every week in Hebrew school. You know, so, I mean, I did not ever make any assumption that they were human in any way.
I have a question. Why did this woman want to be Hitler's secretary? You know, I mean, kind of applying for to be Hitler's secretary at the end of the war is like taking a deck chair on the Titanic.
Well, it's not the job, Riley.
A job.
But, you know, no, but
did she have to pass a typing test to get the gig?
She did. That's how the movie opens.
Really?
With a typing test.
Oh, my God.
Where she, you know,
Hitler, I was only kidding.
No, Hitler brings her into a room and dictates something, and she gets the job. It starts with a typing test.
Oh, my God.
I don't think a lot of regular Germans ever thought that what happened in Berlin would happen. You know, I don't think they saw it coming like, you know, you would assume they would. You know, it's a lot like this country in the sense that, you know, communication was very much stifled. Information was stifled from coming in. These people were led to believe that everything was going to be all right. But the interesting thing, too, is like his attitude in the film, Hitler's attitude about regular Germans was that essentially that, you know, he didn't care if they all got killed because they were too weak to have played their part in defending the city of Berlin.
No, see, I've seen that in the same I saw that in the documentary, that Hitler really just was in complete and utter denial, and whatever happened, it wasn't his fault. It was the fault of his generals. It was apparently had a bunch of them executed not long before he went down into the bunker as well, but it was the fault of the generals. It was the fault of the German people. It was the fault of the, what did they call it? The
Reich Chancellery.
Yeah, but I mean, it was everybody's fault.
Yeah, blame dispersal. It's something very popular with this regime that we have in office now. I'm very happy to see P.W. McDonald, Clutch Larson, in the booth, who's got, I hear a new title. Are we going to discuss that? I don't know if we're going to call him Double Clutch Larson from here on out. Pashman was, you know, giving me a hard time before the show. Very happy to be back. We're going to come back and we're going to talk about how the religious right is, continuing to move into politics. We're gonna talk a little about Terry Schiavo. I know some of you are like, enough already with the Schiavo. But look, I just want to say one thing that, you know, this was, I'm gonna wait till we come back because we'll cover it then. We're gonna talk about DeLay, Tom DeLay's personal history with plug pulling and his daddy. 15 past the hour, Air America Radio.
MorningSedition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your vlog. MorningSedition.com, Air America Radio.
20 past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. It is Monday morning. I've been gone for a week, and I'm just getting used to hearing my own voice in my head again with my headphones as opposed to just the other three that are there without the headphones. You know what I mean? Wow. Oh, I had a great vacation, man. You know when you're on vacation, Riley, you have those moments where you're like, why can't every day be like this?
Yeah.
And another thing I had, because I saw, you know, I saw a few other movies. I saw Fear and Trembling, which is a French film about a Belgian woman who gets a job at a Japanese factory. Very interesting movie. Wow. It's the kind of movies that, you know, they never get made in America. And the kind of thing that makes you think about things in a completely different way.
Oh,
very
wow.
interesting. The kind of movie that Andrew Sarah says, very, very intelligent movie. I saw one other movie. We don't have to talk about movies all day. Let's talk about this this movement in Ohio. The Christian conservative leaders in Ohio are making a... Now, I just read this article, as you did, Riley, in the Sunday Times about Surprise, Arizona, about
yes.
the Radiant Church in Surprise, Arizona. Now, my brother lived nearby out in Cave Creek out by Mesa. I don't know if people fully realize these type of communities that are just sprout out of nowhere. Developers find these chunks of desert where they can build houses for under $150,000 a pop for a big 4-bedroom house or whatever.
Yeah, because they buy the land off farmers, or they buy land off people that really haven't been using it for that long.
Right, so you get this almost pioneering sort of not pioneering spirit, but you get these houses that they're not near anything. You got to drive 50 miles to get anywhere that even looks like a city. So what happens is these guys who want to build congregations go to these areas and they basically try to figure out how to get everybody in the community into the doors of their church and to make an almost, an entire Christian enclave.
Yeah.
Which is what this guy did. They're called megachurches, or they were in the 80s anyways, and there's this whole new breed of megachurch that puts the emphasis on community as opposed to Jesus. And they build these facilities that have, apparently they serve Krispy Kreme donuts every Sunday, right?
Mm-hmm.
They got Game Boys for the kids. They've got, all sorts of subgroups and subdivisions within the church to get people into smaller groups so they could start, kind of cloistering and making a Christian mission part of their life, but not so heavy on the Jesus.
Not so heavy on the Jesus. And they have a lot of, for example, the whole wealth building thing, how you manage your money, the whole rich dad, poor dad
kind
of...
They talk about pornography, how to deal with a pornography problem,
yeah.
how to deal with marital problems. And this is part of the church that John Ashcroft belongs to. What is it called? The Assembly...
Assemblies of God.
The Assemblies of God.
Yeah.
But... And these are Pentecostals. And this guy McFarland, who runs his church in Surprise, Arizona, has gotten rid of almost all. You walk into the place, there's no Jesus is anywhere.
No stained glass.
No stained glass. It's all very middle class, suburban, pablum, American stuff. Hawaiian shirts.
Kind of like the Mall of God.
Exactly. Yeah. It is the Mall of God. And the interesting thing is that it's still a front organization for the same religious affiliation that speaks in tongues, handle snakes, does all sorts of, insane witnessing, and that is, this is what they look like now. Now, in Ohio, I imagine that Christian conservative groups are reaching out to congregations that look a lot like this.
Well, what they're doing in Ohio is very interesting, Mark. I don't know if you've ever heard of the organization called the Club for Growth. The Club for Growth essentially goes out and supports the most arch-conservative candidates put forward by the Republican Party. So, in other words, if there's a Republican primary and there are three candidates running and two of them are moderate Republicans and mm-hmm. one of them is conservative, the Club for Growth steps in and funds the most conservative candidate. Well, if you go out to Ohio, what they've done is create a religious equivalent of the Club for Growth called the Ohio Restoration Project. They've decided to try and network about 2,000 different leaders in the state. These are Pentecostals, Evangelicals, Baptists, Roman Catholics, all into one nebulous network of religious leadership, and they're trying to register a half million new voters. Now, there is, at this point, a three-way race that is shaping up for the governorship of Ohio. The most conservative of those three is an African-American, Kenneth Blackwell, and if you think you've heard his name before on this air, you have, because he was the Secretary of State that oversaw those day-long voting lines for African-Americans his own state.
That oversaw the thief. That oversaw the guaranteed success of
yeah.
the election of George W. Bush in his state by making it very difficult for everybody to vote effectively.
Yeah. Now, here's what, and if you want to know what their agenda is, and understand that Ohio is just one state, and they may be spreading this out into other parts of the country, here's what the pastor of the Fairfield Christian Church and one of the principal organizers of Ohio Restoration says. Quote, "The establishment of the Ohio Republican Party is out of touch with its base. It acts as if it lives in Boston, Massachusetts."
It's out of touch with its base, i.e. religious fanatics of all kinds. But in order to bring that many religious fanatics together, or religious, I guess I'm not going to say they're all fanatics, but religious assemblies or different factions of the Christian church, they're going to have to make a pretty broad message, right? They're going to have to pick a couple of points that they can all agree on and ram those through to the congregations, i.e. Gay marriage, i.e.
All right, but stop there. Remember that Ohio was one of the states that passed a banning of same-sex marriage in the last election.
Mm-hmm.
What the Ohio Restoration Project believes is that they can build off that and that they can reach out to blacks in urban centers in Ohio, places like Cleveland, places like Columbus, places like Akron, Dayton, Youngstown, reach out to blacks who also oppose same-sex marriage and bring them into this tent based on that opposition. That's what they're looking to do. And they also figure that if a black guy's running for governor, you will get some urban black spill off anyway who will vote for him because he's black.
So we've got to figure out a way to fight this. I mean, we've got to figure out. I mean, there's got to be a way to. I mean, I have to assume that within his own state that Blackwell has got enough resistance. I mean, given the fact that, you know, he has been, you know, kind of elevated to this point of, you know, borderline criminality, certainly to Democrats, that they would be enough to mobilize and take him down. But, I mean, they're obviously acting in response to what could possibly be an incredible Democratic backlash against this guy, hopefully.
Well, what the Democrats are hoping is that Blackwell does, in fact, win the Republican primary for governor, because they figure he is probably the easiest candidate. But what the Democrats are counting on is that most of Ohio is not as far to the right as J. Kenneth Blackwell and this network of religious organizations and leadership that's supporting him. That's what they're banking on. I don't know.
Why would they want him to be governor?
Because he'll implement their agenda.
But I mean,
No, they want him to win the primary so their guy can beat him in the general.
All right, well, let's get into Tom DeLay when we get back into, you know, disabled or vegetative, however you want to say it, Terry Schiavo, 27 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Tradition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Yes. 34 past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yep.
The show is Morning Sedition. It is Air America Radio. We've been on the air almost a year. It'll be here on Friday. I believe that our HBO special, Left of the Dial, airs when? Thursday night for the first time? Is that when it airs? When's it first air, Clutch? Thursday? March 31st at 8 p.m. See the inner workings of the near fall of Air America Radio. Yeah, that was quite.
But the resurrection, too, now. You can't. I mean,
well,
we're still here,
dude.
I know. But, you know, everybody is putting this thing in the context of the fall. And I heard an interview with Patrick Farrelly, the filmmaker, the other day. And he said, look, it wasn't just about a fall. At the end, you know, there was a resurrection.
Not only are we resurrected, but we're doing more than ever. We're stronger than ever. Yeah, they all want to focus on that. I did some radio interview with some woman on Radio America or Radio, is that what it's called? I don't even know what it is, what her name was. All I know is she was bitter and snotty to me. She does this big long intro, Jane something. I got to find out what the hell her name was. She does this big long intro of all the things I did, and then she brings me onto the show, and I go, well, that's a very nice intro. I'd forgotten I'd done some of those things. It was very nice of you. She goes, well, you know, most people in radio, they start out, you know, by working in radio, by doing the soundboard, by maybe running errands, by doing anything they can within radio to become a radio personality. I'm like, what are you, bitter? What's the story here? Well, I get it. I came around the side, but, you know, what the hell difference does that make? Then she started talking about, so Air America had problems. Did you have problems? I'm like, yeah, we did have problems for a couple of weeks, but they were all resolved. The great thing about the documentary, if I might add, is me. No, I, no. The great thing, No, it's not it. It's not it. It's not it.
Come on, man. You're hurting Caleb. He's laughing.
I know
he can't afford to laugh with all of this medication in him.
He's got the swollen cheeks from the wisdom teeth. You know, they pull them right out by the root. They get in there. It's like pulling a weed up.
Oh,
yeah.
I have pictures if you want them.
You have pictures with you?
Wow, yeah. You're posting them on the internet, Caleb?
Oh, my God. It's like I knew a con. I think Doug Stanhope actually posted his vasectomy on his website.
Wow.
But dig this. So listen to this. But you should watch the documentary because it is sort of interesting. There were things I didn't know about it because we were sleeping through half of the stuff.
Yeah.
Apparently there were meetings going on. There were things being decided while Riley and I were like, oh man, I got to get up in a few hours. There's so many parties that we miss, Riley. Apparently there's a party at Franken's house. Did you go? No, I didn't go.
No.
Did Clutch Larson go? Yes, he did go. You know why? Because that guy is a blatant networker. That's all he is.
Yeah.
He's a political animal.
Party
he claims
guy.
Not to be, but Clutch Larson is a political animal. He's out there, you know.
Uh-oh.
He's out there.
Now you've done it. What?
I sat in the corner with my wife and said, I hate that one.
Oh.
I told you, political animal. You see
yeah,
how it is?
Yeah.
And, right, and when he went to talk to me, he's like, hey, how are you? Nice to see you. Good to see you. I know how that works. I hate that one.
Yeah.
I'm rambling on, though. But I can tell you this, though. After watching the documentary. I didn't know what this feels like. I didn't walk away saying, you know, like, that sucks. It was a misrepresentation of us. It was a misrepresentation of the network. It was a misrepresentation of me. You know, I didn't feel that. I think in the middle it gets a little chaotic.
Yeah.
You know, did you find that?
Like, I haven't seen it yet. Now, I did hear some feedback.
Riley,
you can go to a screening. It's not that big of a deal.
You've been invited.
I know, but I'm a reclusive type guy.
I know.
I'd like to watch my daughter grow. That's all I like to do. But bottom line, I saw somebody who had seen it. I talked to somebody who had seen it at the end of last week.
Okay.
And the first thing they said was, you're an Arsenal fan?
Yeah, there you go.
Apparently, because I was wearing the Arsenal shirt during the couple of times I was on it.
That's
so,
right.
I mean, hey, that's cool.
Yeah, you're an Arsenal fan, and there was a British woman that worked there?
No.
But hey, I'm not going to say I quibble because that's not quibbling, and that's Mark Riley's line.
Hey.
I have Jeb Bush's Palm Pilot that, you know, that our friend Ramon just dropped off in a Hawaiian shirt.
Uh-oh.
So let's do this, shall we?
Yes.
Okay, 7 a.m., wake up. Before anyone asks me anything, say, I've done all I can do. Okay, let it go, people. This is in reference to the Terri Schiavo case, of course. 7:30 a.m., intervene in something, anything, just to show everyone that I still can. 9 a.m., breakfast, still guilty about Terri Schiavo. No pancakes. Doing a little fasting. Yes. 11 a.m., check polls, blame falling numbers on activist judges who hate Jesus and my brother. 1 p.m., have assistant quietly contact Shivo's parents. Tell them in exchange for a little peace and quiet, they can have my condo in Boca for the weekend or a couple of days at Disney World. Work something out. You know, work it out. Nah. 3 p.m., have assistant make 50th call to the White House. I know he's there, little bastard. 6 p.m., change answering machine message. Hi, this is Jeb Bush. I have to leave for a while on important international business. I'll be back in Florida when things, you know, clear up a little bit. Clear up. Look, I just got to say one thing that's been eating me about the Schiavo case is that, look, this is a woman that risked her life on some level because she had an eating disorder. She had an eating disorder. And that was why she had a potassium imbalance, which is why her brain and her heart stopped working, why she went down. And I have to, you know, be crass, but yet honest, I think the last thing that Terri Schiavo wants is to continue eating. That, you know, and maybe it's wrong of me to say that, but I just think that if we are really going to talk about her wishes as an individual, I mean, if she's awake or alive or anywhere cognizant within that, you know, within that vegetative state, she's probably thinking, how could they have letting me got this fat? Why, you know, why do they keep forcing me to eat? I mean, let's talk about her real desires on some level. The other thing that, you know, I've been through something similar to this once removed. My grandmother went into a coma after a heart attack. And my grandmother explicitly said, look, if I go into a coma, do not keep me on life support. Do not keep me on life support. Now, my mother and my mother's sister, my Aunt Barbara, were down there. And they, you know, didn't look, she wasn't going to come out of it. She was on life support. Whether she was going to come out of it or not was not the issue, Mark. What the issue was her wishes before she died to not be kept on life support in that state. So here's what happens. My aunt Barbara is like, you know, we got to honor her wishes. You know, we've got to take her off this. I don't like seeing her like this. This is not the way she wanted to be seen or be in, and she did not want to be in this state, right? So my Aunt Barbara and my two cousins were like, we have to do this. And my mother was like, I don't know. I mean, who's it hurting?
Oh.
No, but no, on some level, can you understand that, though? I mean, the idea of having her around, you know, was enough. It was not, it didn't make a difference, you know, on some level that to my mother initially, whether or not she wanted to be in that state or not. It's like she didn't want to let her go, you know, because whether she was obviously compromised in the worst kind of way, she was still alive. But, you know, eventually, you know, after, you know, a few weeks of that, the decision was made and my grandmother passed on. But, you know, I understand on some level. You know how people hold on to this, but it's, you know, but you can't go against the wishes of the person who is in the condition, and also you can't disregard, you know, the constitutional rights of her, you know, legal guardian.
Well, you know, the Schindlers, her parents, have long contested the notion that she didn't want to live if she was in this state. The only what they say is Michael Shivel is the only person that she said that to. Therefore, and several of her other siblings have said, well, she wouldn't have, you know, she was a Roman Catholic. She would never have said to anyone that she didn't want to be kept alive. They have actively contested virtually everything that Michael Shivel has said about her wishes in this case. At this point, depending on who you talk to, she may well be, quote, beyond the point of no return, unquote. It looks like at this juncture, the family has asked some protesters, or at least most of the protesters around the hospice, to leave. It seems as though she was given last rites. She was given communion yesterday, apparently a drop of wine on the tongue. So at this point, they seem to have resigned themselves to the fact that she is going to pass away. Now, the issues around this and the politics around this are going to continue to go forward from here on out.
Well, let's kick into some of that, you know, so, you know, we can put it to rest on some level, as, you know, she is slowly put to rest, in that the way that this was used, you know, by the Republicans, the fact that, you know, George Bush left his, you know, ranch to go sign legislation that would enable federal courts to get involved in this particular case goes against all Republican principles in terms of states' rights, number one, right?
Yes.
And number two is that, you know, did it, you know, actually now that apparently everyone knew that that was not going to amount to anything. It was a blind gesture of support it was sort of like he was throwing a bone to his most fanatic base, yes?
Oh, yeah. And
even though that politically, yeah, it would not hurt him.
And if you look at it objectively, here's how it looks. It looks like George W. Bush and the Congress of the United States decided for their own aggrandizement to do this, that they were going to say to the American people, we are going to intercede on the side of life, until they started seeing polling that said a majority of Americans, even a majority of evangelicals, wanted the tube taken out or wanted the tube left out. And then you've seen little by little, since the polling came out, you've seen both the Congress and the President of the United States backing off that initial position. Now, that's how it could look to a cynical political person such as myself. And we still haven't gotten into yet Tom DeLay's moment of truth, and it wasn't in the Terri Schiavo case. It hit closer to home for him than that.
Yeah, let's talk about that when we come back. It's 44 past the hour on Air America Radio.
I'm the Reverend Al Sharpton, reminding you that listening to any radio show besides Morning's Edition is officially considered selling out to the man. So keep it tuned here to Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
Eight past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. There's the fax machine. That is the fax from the Barbara Streisand compound with our liberal agenda for this morning. Here you go. Write these down, people. One, Lent is over. Since you probably didn't give up anything anyway, go on not giving it up. Two, tell people that the final four refers to the remaining number of Tom DeLay's brain cells. Hello, Tom DeLay's brain cells. Okay. Three, praise the movie Guess Who as an amusing parable supporting both racial tolerance and recycling of the plot. Of the plot, folks. Recycling of the plot. Four, no matter what happens today, blame either Florida or Texas. There's a good chance you'll be right. 5. Today's phrase, just drop this into conversation. Hey, Bush, Iraq used to have a culture of life, too, man. Where's their feeding tube? Huh? Huh? Wake up, sheeple. Light a candle for yourself. There you go. Wake up, sheeple. What do you mean?
Well, I just wanted... No, good. Wake
I'm
up,
okay.
sheeple.
Yeah, no, I'm done. Sure? Yeah, I'm good.
Well,
yeah.
I just wanted to say good morning to the Final Four.
Oh, yes. Good morning.
Louisville, North Carolina, Illinois, Michigan State. An incredible weekend of basketball. And I don't watch that much college ball, Maren. I know you're not into sports, but this was high drama that we saw. Oh,
Big stuff.
Man. A couple of overtime games. Whether or not he made a three-point shot, whether his foot was on the line. Just some really, really deep stuff.
I miss all of it. I missed it. And I missed my neighborhood on Easter. Man, my neighborhood, Astoria, dude, the baby lambs in the windows of the butcher shops, man. There is nothing but meat everywhere. I am so close to eating meat, Kalo. It's nuts. I am so close. This vegetarian thing is driving me nuts. I'm starting to jones for meat. I'm just like, can I just get a taste of that? Taste of that steak? Can I just get a taste of that chicken? Is that chicken good? How's that chicken?
How about some chicken skin?
Yeah, chicken skin. I'll just eat the skin that you're going to throw away. Now, we're in the middle of a conversation here about Terry Schiavo, and I know some of you are sick of it, and you think that maybe we're getting distracted by this, but we know exactly why it was done, what's going on. It's a political smokescreen and also a political bone to the worst type of fanatic parts of this of the right's base. The Christo-fascist zombie brigades are out in force, are out in front on their knees, crying, waving their hands at the sky, falling out of wheelchairs in protest, acting hysterical, anything short of... I didn't see anyone down there holding snakes or babbling, claiming to be talking for God. These people, this is what represents this country in the press. This goes out around the world, these ridiculous behaviors by religious fanatics in the name of somebody who is a vegetable. These people are great at appealing to the, if it's not born yet, if it's just a little cluster of cells, it might or might not become a baby, or if it's somebody that is incapable of functioning in life at all, boy, they champion that stuff. When it comes to anything in between that, where are they?
You know what's interesting about this, Mark? You've got the right-wing politicians, particularly on Capitol Hill, who are looking at this very differently from a lot of those folks that have been protesting around the specifics of the Schiavo case. What they're looking at is an angry base of religious conservatives who have now been galvanized against the judiciary in ways that they could have only dreamt of just last year. What this means is there may be an extraordinary backlash if certain politicians on the Hill stand in the way of Bush's judicial nominations. Now, one of the things that's kind of paradoxical for them about this is that many of the people who have ruled against the Schindler family are, in fact, Bush appointees or in lockstep with Bush or Republicans or evangelicals or all three. So it's not like these are people who are, what did somebody say earlier? Folks from Boston, Massachusetts, all in Barney Frank's congressional district. Many of these judges who have ruled against the Schindlers, in other words, to keep the feeding tube out, are the very same people that a lot of these conservative activists would have thought would have gone the other way. So now you've got a situation where the conservatives can say, well, it's all a problem. We're going to have a very strong litmus test to make sure that these judges that are being put on the bench, the federal bench in particular,
are what, religious fanatics?
Are in lockstep with religious fanatics.
Yeah, but that's like, you're telling me that conservative judges made this call. It was the right call to make on
it
behalf
was,
of the judiciary.
Yeah.
Because it's the way it's supposed to function. So now they're going to try and find guys that are even more to the right, or at least ideal. Isn't that...
Even if they don't find anybody further on the right, it's still a good wedge issue for them because they need to stir up popular opinion about the judiciary. You know how often people think of judges if they're not in court?
But aren't you saying that they are encouraging a type of judiciary activism, that they're going to be put in a position to encourage the extreme right form of judiciary activism?
Absolutely. That's been their goal from the beginning. But now they've got an issue. Now they've got the ability to harness all of the bad feelings that these evangelicals have felt about the judiciary anyway. And now they've wrapped it all up and tied it in Terry Schiavo.
But can't we call them hypocrites now because they are desiring the same thing that they are accusing us at? Aren't they guilty of the exact same type of judicial activism that they've always blamed on the liberals? Aren't they doing the same thing?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And they should be called hypocrites from the very beginning that they tried to get the federal government involved in all this. This is precisely the kind of judicial activism that guys like Tom DeLay have been screaming about on the Hill for ages.
Great.
But so now they've managed, even though these rulings have gone against them and they've been largely done by conservative people, the bottom line is the judiciary is the judiciary is the judiciary as far as they're concerned. And if they can marshal this kind of anger at the judiciary, as long as nobody gets hurt, it's a net plus for them.
So not only are they trying to stick the feeding tube back into Terry Schiavo's mouth, they're trying to stick the Christian tube into the Constitution of the United States, and they're trying to wedge religion into the judiciary in an extreme way, which is something that they've always accused liberals of doing with liberalism in on the other side of that spectrum.
And it's a very specific religion that they're trying to wedge in. Consider this for a moment. There was a 6-month-old child named Sun Hudson out in Texas.
Right.
In Texas, under the law that then Governor George W. Bush signed, a hospital can take someone off life support if the family doesn't have the money to pay. They only got 10 days to appeal it. Now, Sun Hudson's mother apparently worships the sun. I mean, that's why they call him Sun Hudson.
Yeah.
She practices a particular type of religion. It is not the same religion as Tom DeLay and the rest of these people have. And some people are arguing that aside from the fact that she was poor and black, that her, you know, that they tried to cast her as being insane for having these particular religious beliefs, and that was the pretext under which they took the life support from Sun Hudson, who took like 3 breaths and then died. And Tom DeLay didn't stand, even though it's from his home state, he didn't stand with her. He didn't stand with Wanda Hudson.
He didn't even stand with his own father.
No.
I mean, they had, you know, in 1988, you know, there was an accident. And before we get into Tom DeLay's father, also, if you want to pipe in on whether or not this was good or bad for the GOP, 866-303-2270. You know, if you have any opinions about whether or not this insane tactic of using this woman, Terry Schiavo, as a puppet for political means, how did it work for them or against them? And also, I'd like to hear from disabled people about calling her disabled as opposed to completely incapacitated.
That's been a very big issue over the last 48 hours.
It's driving me nuts, dude. I was watching last week, and I saw these Christian activists saying, like, this is a disabled person. You can't build a ramp for Terry Schiavo. You know, she's not, if she was just, you know, disabled is used for people who are capable of functioning, you know?
Yeah.
She can't feed herself for 15 years. I mean, what does that mean?
Well, there's some legal issues, and then there are the political issues that are coming behind all this. We'll talk with you on the phone, 866-303-2270, as we continue here on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, progressive utopians with no sense of humor. Good morning to you, working class heroes, everybody, victims and unvictims. Good morning to all of you. Yeah, what are we going to do? Good morning, Mark Riley. I missed you, buddy.
Good morning, Mark Maron. I missed you too, man. I'm glad you're back.
I feel good to be back. Kayla, the Costco hoe, not feeling up to snuff today. Had his wisdom teeth taken out on Fridays, all puffy and Vicodin'd out. As I said earlier, there were another time. Mark Riley, everybody would be Vicodin'd out.
Yes.
Everyone in here would be enjoying Kalo's Vicodin. We'll be, you know, we'd be...
Courtesy of?
Yeah, 3 days from now, I'd be like, dude, talk to your dentist, man. Just tell him it still hurts. You just got to tell him it still hurts. Let's get into... I just wanted to bring up, I will be at Cobb's Comedy Club this Friday and Saturday.
Yeah.
4 big shows. Come on down. See me. That's in San Francisco. So, Sacramento, good morning to you. You can make the trip. It's not that far. Come on down. Or a sideways, or up. I can't remember.
Hop on the freeway. I think it's sideways.
Yeah.
Yeah, kind of sideways.
Sack. I've done sack, too. I used to do the punchline there, too. Also, the woman I was talking about before, I did an interview with this woman on Radio 1, Jane Silk, who was a little snotty. She kept saying, Mark Maron is the host of Morning Sedation. And I'm like, what? You know, and that, at the end of the interview, I'm like, it's sedition. Then she got on the phone with me. I'm sorry. I don't know what I was thinking. Oh, you don't, really? Really, you saw sedation, and somewhere in your head, it sounded like the right name for a morning show. But you didn't know. It was an honest mistake. These people are devious. She's devious. She went on for 15 minutes talking to me about how I ran into Al Franken, and he wasn't very nice to me. Oh, well, okay. Well, you know what?
Congressman.
I'll talk to him about it. Selfish people. So we're going to talk to some callers, but before we do, let's talk about Tom DeLay and his father. First of all, his father, I guess, rigged up some sort of device, some sort of tram that went from the house down to the lake.
Yeah, you know those things that you see on those some of those exotic movies where you have those things that just like ride up and down, I guess, on either on overhead rails or on regular rails, and rich people using to get from their house down to the water or
right.
back.
Well,
and
some
forth.
Horrible accident. He got on it for the first ride, and it threw him into a tree.
It threw him. Yeah, it was actually a tram full of people, but he got thrown into a tree. He was gravely injured. He had head injuries.
Brained him.
Yes. Yeah. And by the way, this was back in 1988. The family got together, and doctors told the family that he would basically be a vegetable. This is according to Congressman Tom DeLay's aunt, Joanne DeLay.
Yeah.
And at that point, when his kidneys failed, Charles DeLay's kidneys failed, the DeLay family decided against connecting him to a dialysis machine. And, of course, this was because he had told family members that he didn't want to be kept alive by artificial means under these kinds of circumstances. And like Terry Schiavo, Charles DeLay left no living will.
But the family members knew. Also, the family sued. They sued the manufacturer of the ball bearing.
Yes.
That was in the tram, correct?
Yep. Settled for about $250,000.
All right. Now, I guess what we're really trying to imply or implicate here about Tom DeLay's character is that it's inconsistent. Is that, you know, this, you know, he was not a champion for his father's, you know, right to stay on a machine, because I guess he was just starting out politically then and he had less to hide. But, you know, now he becomes all of a sudden, you know, the champion of this case in order to obfuscate his own transgressions within Congress and also to, you know, make a rally, you know, around this cause for the extreme right of the base. And, you know, I'm sure that, you know, and to the point where Randall Terry, I guess, the famous sort of Christian lunatic.
Mr. Operation Rescue.
Yeah, he said that apparently Terry Schiavo was making sounds, that he was able to, in all his infinite wisdom, was able to translate, I want to live. So, but clearly it could have went either way. Could have been, you know, I want to die. It could have been, you know.
It could have been anything. And the question then becomes, you know, the family, the mother, was not able to go visit Terry Schiavo yesterday. So now, why is
why? Because there were too many freaks out in front of the place making it difficult for her to get in?
No, she felt it was too emotional that she's watching her daughter pass away. But, you know, why are all these other people there if the family... certainly the one of the key family members who's kept this fight up all this time.
Never about the family, it's about the symbol.
Yeah.
Let's start. Let's take a call. We got Doug listening in the Bronx. How are you, Doug? Good morning.
Yeah, hi guys, Mark and Mark.
Hey, Doug.
Congratulations, by the way, on the 1 year anniversary of
Thank
America.
You. Thank you.
From the beginning. Okay, first of all, two things I want to get try to get to fast. First on the question about disability, I happen to be blind, totally blind. Been so for a little over 20 years. And I do make a distinction personally. I'm a little different from the rest of the disability community. Distinction between someone who has like a life-threatening disease or injury, and someone who has a situation, either a sensory situation or a physical handicap, and I rather call it handicap, that changes the way you have to do things in the world, but isn't life-threatening in and of itself.
But don't you think that they're using
other people don't do that? I
right,
think.
But it just seems to me that the language, by using the language of disability, all they're trying to do is bolster the idea that she is one day going to miraculously be dancing again.
That's a good point. That sort of fits in with what I just said. Now,
right.
There's an organization called Not Dead Yet, a disability organization that I had I've heard on another radio station here in New York that has a disability show once a month, and I actually about a year ago I called into that show on this very topic of Terri Schiavo. It was shortly after the Terri's Law went into effect and went out of effect. And the disabled people who run that show were saying that, you know, they were sort of saying good things about the Republicans in Florida and about Jeb Bush. And I called in to say, don't say that. Don't do that. You're giving them credence. We're going into an election year. I mean, this is a left-wing station. I think you guys can figure out which it is. It's on the FM station, FM dial, very far left-wing station. And so the disability community takes a very even people on that station sometimes take a very unusual stand politically because they don't see the big picture often, and they only are looking at a very narrow way of looking at their personal situations. And
well, I think, Doug, what you're seeing is some people in the disabled community being made very nervous by the Terri Schiavo situation because they think someone could do the same thing to them when they didn't think it, you know, when they didn't want to die. That's
exactly
what they're afraid
of. Says, actually, that this could happen to them personally. I don't think that anybody could mistake her situation is so much more severe. I mean, look, now the second thing I want to get into is the Tom DeLake thing. I read these because I get that through a talking system through a computer, actually through the telephone. That's just sort of blind. The L.A. Times articles from yesterday, I went through them quickly early this morning. This Tom DeLake is such a low-life hypocrite monster. His father's situation was not only the same as Terri's. He was in
an accident. We just talked about that.
Right, but I know. And he was only in a coma. So if anything, he had more of a chance of coming out of it. They dare to claim, and his mother ends the article, Maxine smoking on her cigarette there in the nursing home. She says, oh, he would never come out of it. But Terri could come out of it. Terri is in much less of a situation, is in infinitely more of a dead situation. She is essentially a living corpse, as far as I'm concerned. It seems to me that he was only in this coma for a few months. The father had a much greater chance of coming out of it, and they let him die.
This is
a baby in Texas that we were just talking about. This is an unbelievable infinite evil. But DeLay's hypocrisy goes beyond that.
Absolutely.
He happened to have the lawsuit that he filed against the corporations that made the this tram that they
ball bearing for the
coupling,
tram. Yeah.
That the coupling that's supposed to hold this thing malfunctioned. So they sued two corporations.
Yes.
Doesn't that sound familiar?
Yes.
Maybe it sounds like a guy from North Carolina. I think he used to be a senator. I think his name was Edwards. Sounds like a case that a guy like him would take. So who took the case for Tom DeLay? A guy by the name of DeLay, Randall DeLay, Tom's brother, says the article.
Oh, wow.
Tom's
and this is
his brother.
Yeah.
Randy DeLay is the lawyer for the family that did the lawsuit.
And
that's some amazing stuff, Doug.
Thanks a lot, Doug.
Thanks a lot.
He did a lot of research here, Doug did. But that's interesting because, you know, this would be exactly the type of lawsuit that the Republicans would dismiss as frivolous.
Yeah.
And also there's an interesting thing about, you know, when it is the parent who is in a coma or sick or in a vegetative state, it is a very different dynamic that goes on. Because there's something in my heart that tells me that this woman, Terri Schiavo, was, you know, as a daughter, I wonder, you start to wonder, what was the relationship between father and mother and daughter before this happened? You know, what were the tensions, you know? Because it strikes me that someone like DeLay would, you know, probably say, you know, oh, finally, the old bastard's done. You know, I mean, I don't know, but, you know, I'm making a speculation.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to take some more calls. You know, after this, I found that guy. You know,
that was Doug was compelling.
You have to realize that there are some you know fanatical Christians that think that really death is just a temporary disability. 16 past the hour, Air America Radio. We'll be back.
Call us at 866.
Ha! That's awesome. Go on.
303.
Wow. Yes. Yes. I love it.
2270.
Oh, yeah. Drop the bomb. Drop it. There's not a dry eye in the house. Keep going.
That's 866-303-2270.
Okay. Well, just so you know, it was good, but I was also being pretty generous.
This is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
21 past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
This morning's edition on Air America Radio. Got a few calls coming in about the political impact of the Terri Schiavo case. Uh-huh. Yeah, we're going to take those in just a second. I got therapy coming up in a few days. I've been a week away. Here's my dream diary from last night because he told me to write them down. So I come back from vacation, Riley, and I'm about to go into the studio, but two enormous bodyguards are blocking the door. One looks down at me and says, "Can I help you?" I said, "Yeah, buddy, I'm Mark Maron." Then the one on the left nods, and they escort me into the studio where there's all these lights and a stage and music and a screaming, cheering audience. I sit down in a chair on the stage, and out comes Jerry Springer. And he says, "Today on the Jerry Springer Show, my man is a talk radio perv. First, you may know him as the host of Morning Sedition on Air America Radio, comedian Mark Maron." The audience screams, "Boo! Boo!" I say, "Jerry, what's going on, man? Where's Caleb?" Jerry ignores me and says, "And now the woman who claims that Mark Maron was a cheating pervert who made her life a living hell, Lila Mae Maron." This enormous woman in a beehive hairdo and a miniskirt rushes onto the stage and starts smacking me with a sausage. And she screams, "You! I'll kill you, you a-hole!" As bodyguards wrestle her into a chair, the crowd chants, "Jerry, Jerry, Jerry." Lila says, "Jerry, this little cheated on me with all these skinny little and I thought he loved me. Maron, you got a tiny little be a real man, pencil." Then she rushed me again with a sausage, and I hide behind a bodyguard and scream, "Wait!" The crowd goes quiet. I say, "I think bringing Jerry Springer to Air America will help the network make inroads into an audience we might never reach otherwise. And Lila Mae, I love you." The crowd is silent for a second, then starts chanting, "Maron, Maron, Maron, Maron." Springer comes on. "One final thought. Stereotyping is wrong. Sometimes the least likely person will turn out to be your best friend. Think about it." Next on Springer, "Is your poodle on crystal meth?" I woke up and my bed was filled with working class rage. So now quickly, you know, to get back on topic, apparently there was a report in the Washington Post in May 2001, and this is about Tom DeLay. Tom DeLay, who says that the Christian family values will solve America's problems, and apparently his own family, after the death of his father, that apparently he did not step in to sustain, and won, you know, $250,000 lawsuit off the back of his brother who represented him.
Now, wait. We should say, in fairness, he gave that money to his mother, his share.
Okay, fine. Well, good for her. But I'll tell you this right now. Apparently, he cut off contact with all three of his siblings. Okay, he hasn't talked to his mother in like 2 years. You know, even though she lives like 10 miles away, there's a complete, you know, the family is apparently in shambles. And it's just, it's illustrating the hypocrisy. It's not just slander. When you got a guy that moralizes and plays politics the way DeLay does, on some level, it's fair game to point out that this guy is a complete hypocrite who is also, you know, just saturated with a hunger for power. This is the bug-killing dwarf king of the neocon death cult's legislating pig pack. And, you know, he will do anything to sustain his political career.
You know, you can really capsulize this in one very simple phrase.
Okay.
Hey, Tom! Live your values.
Yeah.
You want to talk all of this smack about how other people should live their lives. And the fact of the matter is you're not prepared to live your life in the way you demand of others. And that is the essence and definition of hypocrisy, Mark Maron.
But living values, I mean, what does it look like? I mean, if these guys are willing to pander to, did you see the people standing in front of this hospice, you know, flailing around on the ground, wobbling back and forth, speaking in tongues, you know, everything short of having snakes out there, you know, they're falling out of wheelchairs. It's a real revival tent BS. I mean, is this what living the values looks like? Is this what these people who live the values look like? Where do they have time to live values when they're not busy, you know, flailing about and making a big show of? If that's what faith looks like in this country, if that's what real true faith looks like, I'm not sure who the hell should be locked up. I think they should be locked up.
Well, you know, it's interesting because you have to start saying, you know, and we talked about this a bit last week when you weren't here, Matt, the question of where the Democrats were on this, and apparently there are a lot of Democrats who think that all this showbiz is going to help them without them having to lift a finger to do anything, because they figure that people are going to see this and they're going to say, hey, you know, these Republicans, they're just overreaching. These folks that are part of this whole Christo-fascist zombie death cup. I mean, that they're going too far. They're pushing the envelope off the edge of the table.
They need to step in. It needs to be stopped. These religious fanatics are they're just a, you know, they're a cancer. They're a cancer in this culture. They're a cancer that is going to pull the country down with them in their simplicity, in their narrow-mindedness, in their fear of progress, in their repression. I mean, this is a national plague that they're afraid to approach. They're afraid to say anything about, you know, because they're afraid that they're going to be implicated. And they play the role of the victim, which is the most aggressive and hostile position you can take, because if you play the role of the victim, you can always lash out and say, see, they're victimizing me again. There's no end to the black hole of the victim's stance on things, you know. And the Democrats have to say something. This has to be stopped. Religious fanaticism is the seeds of fascism in the American culture, and it has to be stopped. Look at those people with snakes speaking in tongues, flailing about, falling out of wheelchairs. They should be in a hospital.
Well, hey, you know, they got problems, Mark. Serious problems. We're going to come back and take some more phone. Well, you know what we got coming up, though? The Morning Remembers.
And we've also got calls. Yeah.
We've got calls. We're going to take some of those calls when we come back here on Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
Before past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
It's Morning's Edition on Air America Radio. The facts, the fury, the funny Morning's Edition. Don't be stupid. It feels like thinking. Right now, we're talking to people on the phone, to you people, 866-303-2270, about the impact that the Terri Schiavo fiasco, symbolic fiasco, politicized, you know, brain-dead puppet, of the Republican death machine, the neocon death cults, legislative pig pack, the leader, the bug-killing dwarf king, Tom DeLay. What is it going to do? How is it going to help? How is it going to hurt? Chris, listening in Florida on Sirius, how are you?
Hi, Chris.
Good morning. How are you?
Good.
I think this is going to help the Republicans in the long run. In 2006 and 2008, mainly because Democrats really don't care. The ones that want to see her die really don't care. And I think they're going to forget about it after she dies in a couple months. Whereas Republicans will remain energized, especially that Christian base. And they go out and vote, and they're about 30% of the electorate in the first place. And they will definitely remember it. In 2006, 2008, they're going to portray Democrats as pro-death and no more values like they normally do.
Pro-death. Isn't it impossible to deny the fact that death happens?
I mean, to me, that's really not the main issue.
No, I know what you're saying, buddy.
The main issue is that the Republicans the propaganda is very good.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for your call, Chris. I know what he's saying, and I think that's we were talking to Pashman before the show. He feels that too, that this will energize that portion of their base that is narrow-minded, limited in their ability to sort of accept things as they are. You know, this is the narrow-minded working bees, the worker ants of the Republican Party is what these people are. They don't think about things very deeply. They're very limited to their ideology, no matter how wrong it may be, and they will never change.
I have one point to quibble with him about. Mm-hmm. They're already energized. They're already active. They've been working since the day after the election. This is something that the Democrats constantly miss in evaluating the opposition here. They didn't take a day off after the election. They have been organized. What we talked about Ohio an hour ago. That's exactly what they're doing.
But it seems to me, it feels to me, though, that there was some, you know, issue around this particular group, this part of the base, were feeling a little disenfranchised by Bush after they felt like they were responsible for putting him in office, that he paid a lot of lip service to changing the Constitution, to ban gay marriages. That's not going to happen. That there are certain things that they felt like he might have been dropping the ball on, and this seemed like the right sort of political bone to throw them, that it worked for everybody. Except because Bush knew that ultimately, you know, it was not going to, you know, the federal judiciary was going to shut it down, right?
Yeah, he knew.
He knew
ahead of time, and he knew that it really wouldn't matter whether it was heard in front of Democrats that were appointed by Bill Clinton or Republicans that were appointed by him. They knew ahead of time.
And you're talking about people that don't care about their, you know, their financial predicaments in this world. They don't look at any of the policy elements that may be affecting them in an adverse way. These are people that care only about this idea of God that they have and they want to put into all of our heads and into the government of this country. That's all they care about.
But they also want to, they are preparing themselves to fight a multi-front battle.
The Republicans are.
Oh, not just the Republicans, the religious right. They are fighting the battle of the culture wars. The FCC trying to ban this and ban that and extend, you know, indecency issues and the jurisdiction
right.
of the FCC. And the, they are fighting all of these battles at the same time.
And they're getting stronger.
Yeah, they're getting stronger. And the thing is, people need to rally around progressive issues and people that articulate the progressive issues, not just as a counterbalance to them, but as the foundation on which will be built our own progressive vision of the world. See, they're real clear about what they want, and they think, in some cases correctly, that we're not. That progressives don't really know what it is we want.
Well, the thing is, it's not a matter of not knowing what we want. We just have a hard time in relation to people that are so committed to narrow-minded ideology. They are so committed to views that are not founded in reality, and that you can't. They're unshakable like that. So you know, to engage them in progressive conversation about anything that has to do with reality or policy or how people are really treated, if it goes against what they think. If it goes against their religious beliefs at all, then there's no conversation.
No, and they don't want there to. The Republicans and the evangelicals don't want there to be a confrontation or a conversation, I'm sorry, because they believe that that's the best means to their end. They don't want to engage in discussion and dialogue on these sorts of things. Now, the question then becomes, are there people on the left who are prepared to take the same kind of strategy, the same kind of take no prisoners attitude, the same notion that your opposition is meat, okay? That your opposition is a nice, juicy steak sitting there for you to eat.
Yeah, there are. I believe that there are, but a lot of times.
Yeah, moveon.org, but then where else?
They're overly specific. You know what I mean? They're overly specific about which elements that they'll fight and which elements they won't fight. It's very hard to put together a full-on assault on this sort of, you know, the narrow-minded ideology of these Christo-fascist army brigades. It's very difficult to get them in, you know, to meet them, you know, exactly head-on and cover all the topics they do, because these people, there are certain things that just, it's a dead-end street. The conversation, there is no conversation. That God created the world. End of story. No evolution. You know, a fetus is a human. That's it. No, there's no conversation about that, you know. This Terry Schiavo could be, you know, composing music next week. There's no conversation.
I know, and gays are going to undermine the foundation of American culture for the last 300 years. There's no conversation about that.
These are frightened, intentionally stupid people that are unable to accept life as it is. These people are, they think that they can control everything and change everything to the world that they want it to be, which is impossible and fascistic.
Well, then we should beat them. And we should concentrate our efforts on beating them at every turn, every initiative, every front. And we can do it. That's the problem I have. I get a sense sometimes in talking to people, even within the progressive umbrella, that they don't think we can do. We can't organize like the Republicans. We can't. Yes, we can. And we can win. We can beat them down, and we can win if we're organized and if we're smart.
You know, there's this weird mixture of self-defeatism and self-righteousness that comes in liberal packages. You know, it's like, you know, hey, man, this is what's right, but I don't know how we're going to get it done. You know, I mean, it's like, dude, it makes so much sense, but there's just no way to, you know, facilitate it. So, I don't know. Do you want to get something to eat? All right, here we go. Chris, listening in Arkansas. Good morning, Chris.
Hey, Chris.
Hi there.
Hi. What's on your mind?
Well, I had two things to say. One is I really think that FCC doesn't stand for what they claim it stands for. It actually stands for the Fascist Censorship Commission.
Okay. I like that.
And the second thing is that the whole Terry Schiavo case, I bet my husband that if he talked to his parents, they wouldn't respect his wishes because he was certain that they knew that if he ended up in a state like that, he wanted to have the plug pulled after 1 year.
Right.
Give him 1 year to either come out of it or not.
Mm-hmm.
And I bet him that his mom would fight me in court if need be if I tried to do it. And she said that when he called her, she said that unless he had it in writing ahead of time that he only wanted 1 year, that it didn't matter that he told her over the phone that those were his wishes, she would still fight me in court if I tried to.
Unbelievable. Is that for religious reasons or just because how she feels about her son or what?
It's a mixture of the two. I find it absolutely baffling. She claims to be a progressive liberal, but she is anti-abortion. She is anti-homosexual. And, I mean, she is conservative on so many issues that it's just, I don't see how she can claim to be.
Does she get along with her son?
More like she tries to control him every time he's within.
She tries to control him. That's interesting because, see, it's my belief that, you know, that unresolved parent-child issues are at the core of a lot of what's going on here. What could be a more controllable state than vegetative? You know, I mean, this is, you know, and I felt sort of ashamed of myself because of the type of feelings that I, the speculations that I make in my own mind about this. Because my speculations, and only, you know, I don't know if this has been in the newspapers, is that this girl, Terry, did not get along so great with her parents.
You know, it's an interesting question. And one of the things that Chris's conversation speaks to is a tremendous spike, Mark, since the Schiavo case become national news, in interest about living wills. There have been inquiries up the wazoo all over America about living wills as a result of the fact that Terry Schiavo didn't have one. Apparently, neither did Tom DeLay's father, Charles, for that matter.
I'm not sure. I don't have one. Do I got to write it down?
It might help. I mean, if it's about that specific issue, if it's about if something catastrophic happens to you and whether or not you should be kept alive, then maybe, I mean...
Can it just be like no pictures?
Well, I hope so.
I mean, man, I can't, some of the footage, man, I mean, come on.
No. Well, yeah, you could say in there, if I'm in a vegetative state, don't take my picture, don't roll any videotape. You could say that in a living will, absolutely.
Okay, well, we're going to come back with Morning Remembrance after this. Thank you for all your calls. We'll talk to you again soon. It's Air America Radio, 45 past the hour. Did I say that already? We'll be back.
Hey, this is Ted Leo, and you're listening to The Spirit of Radio, Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
All right, buddy. All right. It's good to be back, man. Day one, getting back into the groove.
You gotta listen to the lyrics to this song. They're great.
I will do that. Not right now, though.
Not now. No. We got somebody else right. To talk to.
Well, you know, unfortunately, Riley, it's that time of week again when we hear it. When we hear Morning Sedition, take a moment at this time of sorrow to reflect in our morning remembrance.
As the people of a grieving nation come together to mourn, to remember, and finally to find hope, Morning Sedition joins with them to mourn, remember, and find hope as well. And so we bring you the stories of those who have lost their lives, those who inspire us to carry on. Here now is Morning Sedition grief correspondent, Mort Mortensen.
Paul Henning, television producer. Paul Henning, television writer and producer who created such hits as The Beverly Hillbillies, Petticoat Junction, and Green Acres, has finally been canceled. Henning reportedly died of a massive stroke after actually seeing an episode of Petticoat Junction for the first time. It's got something in my eye.
You all right, man?
Yeah, all right. I really take you. Mr. Henning came up with the idea for the Beverly Hillbillies after being inspired by childhood memories of his days in the Ozarks, in a remote little town where apparently every family had a banker with a lesbian secretary. Speaking of lesbian secretary, are you wearing musk? You know, I'm allergic to musk.
Yeah,
oh, yeah.
I got a little musk on.
Okay. Historians say the Beverly Hillbillies episodes that aired in the weeks after JFK's assassination are still the highest rated half-hour shows ever, owing to the millions of shocked Americans hoping they might see FBI agents rough up the Clampett. Payback to the South. Do I have a tissue?
Yeah, here, wait. Let me get you one. Here you go.
Thanks, man. Yeah, sure. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. We'll clean that mic later.
Allergies.
Yeah, I know. It's bad.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
Tell me.
Yeah. let me get on with this, all right?
Henning requested his body be buried anywhere obsessed fans couldn't get close enough to spray paint his tomb with things like cement pond, vittles, or bug tussles. I know you got some perfume on.
Yeah, I might. I don't remember putting it on, but I might have a little.
Yeah. Auto innovator John DeLorean. John DeLorean, former vice president of General Motors and creator of the self-named sports car of the 1980s, died in New Jersey when his pump finally gave out after nearly 25 years of racing away from creditors and fraud convictions.
Oh, man. You want another Kleenex?
Yeah. Thank you.
That was a little one.
Yeah. In 1964, as General Motors designer, he created the first muscle car by cramming a V8 engine into a Pontiac and calling it the GTO. 20 years later, as head of DeLorean Motors, he created his first arrest by cramming 200 pounds of cocaine into a suitcase and calling it police entrapment. Is this chair made out of sheepskin?
It might be. I'll look into it.
Yeah, it's sheepskin. Any kind of fur.
Yeah, we'll get rid of it.
All right. DeLorean's place in auto history was assured as soon as his first sports car rumbled off the assembly line. Not because he made them out of space-age materials with gold-wing doors, but because he was dumb enough to build them in Belfast. Hey, who the hell wants a car made in Belfast? Yeah, a lot of histamines in Belfast. It's very damp there.
It's very green.
A lot
of pollen.
Oh, yeah, be started on the pollen and the green stuff, fella. Because you'll get me going for hours. All right. Oh, my eyes are tearing up.
I'm sorry.
I got one last comment to make on this poor man. The deceased requested his memorial service feature a coffin with a lid that opens upward and outward for easy and unobstructive access.
Made out of stainless steel?
Yeah, stainless steel. Revolutionary coffin. Just people just weren't but short-sighted. They didn't see the coffin revolution.
Yeah, I know.
Okay.
You ever think about taking, pills for the allergies?
Or? Yeah, I take the pills and I get really depressed.
I understand.
Okay, let me sign off here.
Yeah. Okay.
This has been this week's Morning Remembrance. Until next week, this is Mort Mortensen saying, who's chopping onions?
Thanks, Mort. Thanks a lot. You can take care. You know, I saw a DeLorean in the parking lot I went to the Arclight Cinema in Los Angeles, mm-hmm. and there was a mint condition DeLorean.
Was it somebody actually driving it?
Yeah.
Wow. You know, about 9,000 were made. He only sold 4,000 of them.
Four thousand. All right, buddy.
Yeah.
Well, you have a good day, man. Try to.
Thanks, man.
I'll get rid of that chair for you and make sure I don't wear any musk next time.
I love you guys.
I love you too, man.
Wow.
I did actually see one. And also I found out that the ArcLight Cinema in Los Angeles owned by Scientologists. Man, the Scientologists in Los Angeles. When are we going to do that show, Clutch Larson? When do we do the Scientology show? Are we afraid? Are we afraid to talk about them? Should we be afraid?
Very afraid.
Really?
Well, I don't know. In the subways here in New York, they've got the come get your stress,
where you hold the cans and freak says, you're in trouble.
Yeah, and then they got stacks and stacks of L. Ron Hubbard books all over
the place. I tell you, I won't read that book, and I'm a guy who likes to read books. I'll read books about anything of any kind, but that one scares me.
I always thought L. Ron Hubbard, if he followed his own precepts, he'd live to be like 95 or something.
He might still be alive.
When he died?
Might still be alive.
Oh, this is like Haile Selassie?
I don't know, man. Who knows?
This is like the Rastafarians and Haile Selassie?
All I know, dude, is I will not pick up Dianetics because I'm afraid that I don't have the fortitude to fight it.
Wow.
You never know. At what page do you snap? I mean, it's fairly effective with, I don't know if they're reasonable people, but they have a military branch of Scientology. I don't know if they're military, but they have uniforms.
They got a legal branch. They sue anybody that says a discouraging word.
I'm telling you, they got uniformed people.
Uniformed Scientologists?
Maybe they're making an army.
Well, what do they these military scientists?
I have no idea, but they wear outfits. You give people a uniform, it doesn't matter what they do. They're in uniform, and they just stand there in uniform.
I don't know. They may be coming up in the elevator now because we're talking about it.
The ArcLight Cinema, though, happens to be a great cinema. That's the issue. And I was, when I found out that they were owned by Scientologists, then I was looking at the coming attraction for subliminal messages.
Ooh.
L. Ron Hubbard. But I didn't see any. Listen, we got a guest coming up next
hour. We got a guest coming up next hour. Who's going to tell us whether Paul Wolfowitz, as head of the World Bank, will actually do anything about poverty on the planet.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
All right.
Enough with the funnies. This is Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Hi.
All right, there we go. 6 past the hour, Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Good morning.
You, of course, are the geniuses and philosopher kings and queens and progressive utopians with no sense of humor, working class heroes of our audience. Good morning to you. Good morning to people that take the victim's point of view. Good morning to you folks that are protected by victim ideology. I've become sort of obsessed with the ideology of victimness there, Riley.
Why?
Well, I don't know. I was reading something about the tactic of being a victim. That, when you play a victim or present yourself as a victim, it's ultimately a very hostile act because, you've put yourself into this position of being able to accuse anybody and anything of victimizing you. That if anyone tries to argue with where you stand, you can go, see, you're just oppressing me. You know what I mean? There's no argument from that point of view.
See? You're oppressing me.
No. How's
that? Is that good?
Yeah. So it's nice to see you. I've been away for a week.
It's good to see you back, man.
Just listening in now. Kalo, I'd love to talk to you, but I know you're compromised. Kalo.
No, he's been coming back little by little, though. He's not the same Kalo he was at 6 o'clock this morning.
He has wisdom teeth out, and he's on a couple of Vicodin, and, we're all sitting here kind of, I feel bad for him, but I'm a little jealous.
I'm a little jealous
he enjoys the Vicodin. He got up and out of nowhere, just came over and hugged me.
Yeah,
that's the Vicodin talking. Because usually, Kalo, as nice as he is, I don't expect that kind of behavior from him. But I'll tell you something. Can I just talk about this for a second, Kalo, do we still have a bet or we don't have a bet? Are we done with our bet, the vegetarian bet? Are we done with it?
I think it's still going on, sure.
Why not? All right, I'm coming up on 2 months, and, dude, I want a steak or something. I mean, it's not even a steak, Kalo. I'm just tired of feeling doughy. I'm tired of eating beans. I'm tired of eating the, cereal. I'm tired of eating the tofu. Yeah. I eat some fish, but fish isn't satisfying enough. I don't even want chicken. I just want to have a pork chop or maybe some turkey breast. I'm starting to crave it too, because I spent the entire I had a great time at home. But I'm telling you, when you're a vegetarian, why not a pint of ice cream and a half? pint and a half of ice cream. It's all I can eat. How about some more cheese? I think my arteries are clogged with dairy products. I think that this vegetarianism has made my cholesterol higher. Though, and why am I committed to it, Riley?
Soy! Tofu!
I know, but why am I committed to it? Is it because of my feelings for the animals? Not completely. Is it because I kind of got grossed out and I on some meat? A little bit. Is it because I don't trust that we are protected? We are protected, yeah.
It's by Chris Lopresto.
Yeah,
is the reason.
No.
Yeah,
no, this happened after. I wouldn't do this just for a bet. But, I mean, I'm
it's not for the bet. I'm not saying it's
I'm
for the bet.
I'm starting to waffle.
You're trying to make him feel bad.
Oh,
You're trying to say, hey, man, did it, and I did it when you said I couldn't do it.
Oh, yeah, but I'm just starting to waffle. I'm sort of craving, and you know, and I you know what it comes down to? I have an eating disorder. That's what it comes down to. I need to go to OA. I need to go somewhere. Look, I'm not a fat
You're
person.
You're not an overeater. How can you go to OA?
But I'm obsessed.
People who go to OA will hate you. They'll hate you for going to the session because they're going to look at you and say, wait a minute, what are you doing here?
But I don't know why my brain thinks about food constantly. You know, it's like ridiculous.
It's sustenance, man.
But it's not. It's
ridiculous. The F word.
It's an obsession. You know, I'm obsessed with food, and I've got to get past it. Because look at right now. I'm wasting the nation's time on my food issues.
Oh.
I'm wasting the time of millions right now. And thank you for the thousands of emails that came in wondering when I was going to get back. I really appreciate that support. That was very nice. And by the way, no longer reading the email. Detaching with love.
Uh-oh.
I was having an insanely ridiculous codependent relationship with strange people in the dark at home going onto the email. And I've cut myself loose. I haven't looked at them in weeks, or actually just a week. You know why? Because I wasn't here. All right, so look, I want to send a special hello to the people out in Sacramento listening to 1240 AM Talk City.
Yeah.
Good morning. I just want to say good morning, because there was a little bird got in my ear that you're feeling neglected. And I want to say I've been to Sacramento. I enjoy it. And as Todd Berry said, they have a lot of Mongolian barbecue places there. And
nothing wrong with that.
No, I have no problem with that. And also, it's the capital of California.
Yes.
And they have the Punchline where I used to perform. And you can now drive to see me in San Francisco this week, and I'll be at Cobb's Comedy Club. That's the first and the second Friday and Saturday night, two shows a night. Looking forward to that, going to San Francisco, doing a lot of traveling, Riley.
Yeah, man, you've been flying on a lot of planes. Was it bad flying in?
That's all you think about. It's like, oh, you're going up again.
Yeah,
you're going
man.
Up into the... Dude, I flew back on JetBlue. Crazy turbulence.
Really?
Crazy. But, you know, it's weird. I don't have the time to worry about it. It becomes annoying more than frightening to me. It's sort of like, okay, now let's straighten it out.
How high up were you?
What do you mean, how? It was in a plane.
No, I mean, what was the altitude? Sometimes turbulence, you know, they'll drop the altitude. If it's too turbulent at 35, they'll drop it down to 23 or vice versa.
He was going around, but I'll tell you, I think that the JetBlue, the one they've been assigned, whatever level they're assigned, is the bumpy one, because going out there was bumpy. And I'm watching the TV, and I'm eating my blue chips. You don't get, it's weird. You don't get much on JetBlue. They don't give you food, but they have these snacks that they give you. And I'll tell you, when I'm on JetBlue, I'm sort of like, I'm going to get some animal crackers. I'm a grown person. I'm like, yeah, I'm going to get two bags of animal crackers. I can eat as many animal crackers as I want and chocolate chip biscotti.
No honey roasted peanuts?
They got some of those, sure.
Oh, yeah, well, that's cool.
But they're all right. They give you. They don't get any food. You got to bring your own food. And but anyways, you know, let's move into some of the more important issues of the day.
Okay.
George Bush finally pipes up, speaks up, says something about the school shooting on the Indian reservation. You know, this was a horrendous tragedy, and he would not talk about it. And when he did finally talk about it, it was almost as if he was forced to, just paying lip service, kind of detached, and making an insinuation that I found disconcerting. Chris, can we hear that sound?
Children benefit from a sense of community and the support and involvement of caring adults. To keep our children safe and protected, we must continue to foster a culture that affirms life and provides love and helps our young people build character.
What does that mean exactly? What a detached, sort of insane, kind of like, you know, just reading by rote, didn't get behind it, didn't try to sell it. This was the worst school shooting, you know, in 6 years, you know, probably the second worst in history, you know. And, you know, this is like, what is it, almost a week later, for God's sakes? He basically gets out and says, look, you know, some, the kids who live through this are going to, they're going to have something to build character on. Did he basically insinuate that, you know, that in a culture of love where everyone's taken care of, you know, that's something we can all hope for? But in this case, you know, this is character building. Seeing your buddies get gunned down for no reason by a guy you knew yesterday just to be the weird kid, you know what I mean? That's character building. One of those things where it's like, you know, this will make you tougher.
Hey, nobody thinks he wrote the stuff himself. You listen to that last bite we listened to. Would you think he wrote that? I'm just trying to figure out whether it was Rove or Melman or maybe his wife. I don't know.
It wasn't even that clever. It sounded like it was one of the interns wrote that.
Yeah, throw me something together. So the Native Americans get a little upset. Obviously, if you listen to what he said, you know he's never been on a reservation. Because if he had been, he'd know that, you know, creating a sense of community is not as easy as it sounds. This is not like you're doing it in the suburbs someplace. I've spent time on a reservation, Mark, in South Dakota, and believe me, it is a very, very different experience.
It's pretty hardcore. It's pretty run down and sad, isn't it?
It is, and I mean, there are a lot of heroic stories on most reservations, but the amazing thing is that things that we absolutely take for granted here, like being able to get into a car and go someplace to work. There are people who hitchhike 35 miles to get to their jobs.
I read a book by, I think the guy's name is Ian Frazier, who wrote a book called On the Rez. I became very into this book because there was something interesting about Indian culture that I didn't realize in sort of what you're talking about, that some of them, apparently, their sense of time is a little different, that the actual process of doing something or getting somewhere could be the actual, that's what you're doing.
That is what you're doing. It's part of your work. Yeah. So your commutation becomes your job.
Yeah. That's a fascinating book in terms of what is left about, you know, in Indian culture, about the way that they see the world and how they approach, you know, contemporary life outside the tremendous obstacles that many of them have to deal with, you know, every day on the reservation. But this also goes into a discussion about, you know, whether or not, if this were a white school, if this were a upper middle class neighborhood, would the president have responded quicker? Would the national conversation be different? I mean, not only is this an Indian reservation, but they're pretty out there.
It's an obscure Indian. What is it? About 100 miles from the Canadian border. It has apparently a casino somewhere on the reservation, but nobody goes because there are so many that are so much closer to the big population centers of Minneapolis and St. Paul.
Right, and I think it's a much smaller operation. But, you know, it just goes, I just felt that the way he presented that bit of business, you know, the way he tried to appeal was just so, it was lackadaisical almost and completely detached. Is that the wrong word?
No, it's not the wrong word, because the question then becomes, would he have said anything had he not been criticized in the first place for not saying anything?
Yeah.
And I'm not sure.
Yeah, well, let's come back. We're going to talk about, you know, the people that he really does care about are not people at all. Their businesses, their corporations, their manufacturing plants. Those are the people that George W. Bush fights for, and those are the people that are getting the big payoffs under this administration. We'll look into that a little bit in a minute. 16 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition.
Just wake up.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
I've heard about those people.
On Air America Radio.
Thanks.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. Well, wow, I haven't seen this in a while. This is my iNews 5000 Wi-Fi headline translators.
Uh-oh.
That's right, my friend. Let's feed it some headlines and see what it has to say. How about that? All right, from the New York Times. Investigation of insurance puts Buffett in a spotlight. Investigation of insurance puts Buffett in a spotlight. Translation, Schiavo case enters bummer phase. Media begins distancing process. From Fox News, Revenge of the Sith, darker than other Star Wars films. Put that into the old machine. Revenge of the Sith, darker than other Star Wars films. Translation, Lucas outrages fundamentalists by ignoring Schiavo case. Here we go. From Sports Illustrated, Spartans make up for struggles with Final Four berth. How's that going there? Translation. Spartans make up for struggles with Final Four birth. Translation is Grateful Nation thanks college hoopsters for Shivo distraction. All right, so let's do this. Now, as I said before, if you were listening and are still listening, the people that really benefit under this particular administration, and of course under many Republican administrations, are people like MBNA Corporation, are people like ExxonMobil Corporation, are people like Walmart Stores Incorporated. They're not people at all. They are corporations, business entities that have been thriving because of this administration's policy. Obviously, MBNA Corporation, the credit card behemoth, the fifth largest contributor to the Bush's two presidential campaigns, made a tremendous windfall for itself by, you know, this bankruptcy legislation.
The bankruptcy bill, sure.
Which basically puts bankruptcy courts into the position of being credit collectors, right? Bill,
yeah,
that's basically what it is. And, of course, Walmart is apparently the most sued company on the planet now that the class action suits can only be filed at a federal level and no longer at a state level. That helps them a great deal in buffering themselves. And then ExxonMobil, of course, being enabled to drill in the Arctic National Wildlife Reserve is seeing, you know, at least a win, what they would see as a windfall for them on some level, though apparently there's not much up there. They just want to drill into the park to make jobs.
Well, they want to make jobs, and they also want to be able to drill off the coast of California.
How could I forget about that? The guy who wants jobs is the Alaskan representative. He says this would be great either way. Ted Stevens will make a bunch of jobs, and if it tanks out, we'll have a bunch of cleanup jobs. But ultimately, if they can set this precedent, they will be able to drill anywhere.
You know, Mark, one of the things that this does is highlight a difference that we talked about a little bit earlier, where the religious right was looking for certain things from the Bush administration, while all the while, who was Bush dealing with? What was his agenda dealing with first as a top priority? Taking care of the corporations that took care of him. Then maybe they'll get around to the religious right. But right now, they're taking care of the people that are contributing to his campaign and contributing to the Republican Party, because Bush sees his presidency as a legacy, as the catalyst to a long Republican dominance of the American political process.
Okay.
So
yeah.
MBNA and Walmart and ExxonMobil, and these are the folks that were first in line because they came with the dollars.
Yeah, well, it's like people are disposable in the legacy of corporations and in the legacy of presidents. That, you know, this president in particular, is that corporations don't care about individuals. They just don't. And they know that this, some of this stuff, this policy that was put into place, will protect them from, you know, having to be, you know, decent players on the world stage, on the domestic stage, on the national stage, in terms of you know, protecting their consumers, protecting people, protecting citizens of the country.
Well, yeah, and you know, when you look at corporations, Mark, you know, corporate bankruptcy was never a target of this bankruptcy bill. You'll notice they were going after Chapter 7, not Chapter 11. And, you know, guys like George W. Bush, who, by the way, ran an oil company that came dangerously close to filing Chapter 11 at one point before they got bought up by somebody else, you know, you start to realize that it is the corporation that he believes to some extent should have primacy in this society.
So his legacy may be great with the business world, but right now his approval rating is as low as it's ever been. It has slipped to 45%.
That's in the toilet.
Yeah, but which is terrific. I think that deserves a... George Bush, President George W. Bush's approval rating now at 45%, the lowest of his presidency. And you know what? He doesn't care. These guys, I mean, he doesn't care. These
I've
guys
been reelected. Been, yeah, don't bother me with polls. Don't
so
give me anything about approval ratings.
The idea of the mandate, the idea that people like him. And we've only got a minute, but the interesting thing is some of this business, being sympathetic and condoning any sort of business practice, if it serves a business community, is also happening in Iraq in the matter of you know, some of these contractors who have basically pilfered money, stole money.
Robbed them blind like they were rolling drunks, for God's sake.
Is this administration going to take any action against Custer battles?
It
no.
doesn't look like it. As a matter of fact, former senior advisor to the Coalition Provisional Authority, Franklin Willis, says that Iraq has become a free fraud zone.
Right, because it's not under American law. But the thing is that the fact that the Bush administration or anyone in this administration is turning their back on even taking any action whatsoever, they're like, hey, who cares? It's American businesses that it's going into. Who cares if it's the taxpayers' money? Who cares if it's made on the backs of people who are, you know, not in support of this particular conflict? That doesn't make any difference.
It doesn't make any difference, and they're doing the same thing that they did with those soldiers that were trying to get money from the first Gulf War. They're using legal trickery and legal language to try and weasel out of taking a position. When we come back, we're going to be talking with economist Jeffrey Sachs. He's going to talk about Paul Wolfowitz. He's going to talk about poverty. He's going to talk about Wolfowitz's ability to deal with poverty.
Can money help?
Air America. Morning Tradition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Thirty-four past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Look, we know a lot of people out there out of work and spent their Sundays leafing through the want ads or monster.com, and we want to help. We want to help be part of the solution, not part of the problem. So here is our Morning Sedition Monday job listing. Republican Party seeking new vegetable mascot. We at the Republican Party are currently seeking a replacement mascot to help fight the vast liberal conspiracy. The position should be opening up any second now, depending on how long human beings can survive on their own body fat. The successful candidate will be sent by God and enjoy spending long periods of time lying in bed, not watching TV test patterns. Ideally, you must have at least 15 years experience of having no experiences whatsoever. This is a full-time permanent position. In fact, we predict it will last the rest of your life with the possibility of promotion to the level of martyr. Benefits include free hydration, liquid meals, and also dental. Well, let's get serious here. You're never going to need that. Detail-oriented, highly motivated, self-starters need not apply.
Ooh.
Okay, right now it's a pleasure to have our guest. He's the author of The End of Poverty, Economic Possibilities for Our Time. He is the economist, Jeffrey Sachs. Good morning, Jeffrey Sachs.
Good morning. How are you?
Good morning.
We're all pretty good here. We're wondering, though, you know, obviously Paul Wolfowitz is an evil bastard, and obviously, you know, the World Bank has got a pretty bad reputation as, you know, sort of like collapsing and ruining you know, nations' economies that are in debt to it. How can we solve some of the problems you talk about in your book through these two people if that's going to be the way it's going to be?
Well, I think that there are two world banks, and this is important to understand. One world bank is the one that you might imagine is under the thumb of the U.S. The bank sits at 18th and Pennsylvania Avenue. It's two blocks down from the White House and three blocks down from the Treasury.
Mm-hmm.
And that World Bank is not solving problems. That World Bank is, for 25 years, was squeezing countries in what they called structural adjustment. Then there's another World Bank. There are 183 other member governments of the World Bank. They actually count for something. They represent the other 95% of the world's population, actually.
You mean there's other people out there, Jeffrey?
Well, no, I know this is a little bit shocking early in the morning. certainly the news has not reached Washington, but it is an amazing thing, actually. The world is actually filled with other people as well.
Oh,
and
my God.
They kind of take themselves seriously, and they wonder, isn't the World Bank a multilateral institution?
Mm-hmm.
Are they all part of it? And the odd thing is, if you look at the Articles of Agreement, that's the kind of the way the thing was set up, it doesn't say that the White House will own and operate the World Bank and appoint the president. It says there will be a vote by the member governments through the executive directors. Now, the United States has 16% of the vote. It doesn't say it owns the position. And it's quite odd. You know, all I've been suggesting is why don't we actually ask candidates their views on issues? This seems like a pretty radical suggestion to a lot of people. You know, instead of just voting a World Bank president and guessing, what does this guy stand for? Closing down the developing world, supporting development, whatever. Why don't we ask first? And the reason apparently we're not asking, it seems, is that Europe, which has a lot of the other votes,
says, well, don't rock the boat. We'll take our positions in the international firmament. The U.S. will take its positions. Mm-hmm. We'll kind of divide the turf. And meanwhile, the 80% of the world that's actually in the developing countries isn't exactly consulted on any of this.
Really, their voices aren't heard in the poorer countries in the world.
Well, I mean, the voices are heard in the poorer countries. They're just not heard in Washington, are they?
That's right.
You know, one of the things I've been curious about in reading some material on this, there seemed to be, when Wolfowitz was first appointed by the president or nominated by the president, some question on the part of the European countries as to whether or not he would have some people from developing countries as his deputies. Where do you think that is now? I mean, are we going to see deputies, for example, from a South Africa or from a Brazil or someplace like that?
Well, it's interesting. In today's Financial Times, the story is that the Europeans are jockeying for their own person as number two at the bank, in other words, a senior European. And again, is anybody interested in the substance, or is it all about jobs? It is rather an important question. You know, this is not a game, believe it or not, although it's treated like a game. It's treated like a joke. One of the letters in the Financial Times today is just incredible. It says, you know, why does Sachs say that we ought to ask the World Bank president his position on the Millennium Development Goals or on development aid? This stuff's a joke. This stuff is feel-good nonsense. Let's get real. And the fact of the matter is that's exactly the Washington cynicism. We sign on to things like cutting poverty. We say we're going to do something, and then, you know, not so deep from the surface, it's all treated as a joke. It's not a joke for 8 million people who will die this year because they're impoverished and because the United States is spending its emergency congressional hours debating the state of a woman in 15 years permanent vegetative state and not the 20,000 children who will die today.
Well, that is the amazing hypocrisy of a certain branch of Christian pseudo-Christian thinking, certainly in this country. But let's talk about some practical approaches, because I read in your piece, it's very fascinating in terms of just resources, just energy resources that are being depleted globally, and the sort of the rising of China as being probably the next huge economic power. What are some practical approaches that you see need to be done, Jeffrey Sachs?
Well, the first thing is I think that people that are alive today and really alive today and that are going to die today because they don't have something as simple as a bed net to protect them against malaria or a $1 pill to save them if they're sick from malaria or a 30-cent pill today for HIV, for AIDS, that is. This is unconscionable. And the fact of the matter is, you know, the heartland of America, if I may say, wants to help. They're just told relentlessly in the spin by Washington, we're doing everything we can, we're generous, we're wonderful, we really care, but it's all those corrupt, poor people. The spin from Washington is that the poor of the world are our enemies. They're out to grab our money. They're just, you know, really despicable, shiftless, corrupt people, and we're holding the line. And it's a huge lie, and it is a huge lie that's of convenience to I suppose, to rich people that don't want to lift any finger at all to do anything. But people in throughout America that are hearing the real message, how about us helping save children because it would be so easy to do, they get quite interested, actually. I think this is the most promising thing. If people would know and could know what America could really do, rather than spending $500 billion on the military and about 1/30 of that to help peacefully international development, if we really invested to control malaria, to help people have safe drinking water, to help keep children alive, Americans would rally to that, and it wouldn't matter what political party it is. They've just not told the truth.
But Jeffrey Sachs, isn't part of the problem here that Americans don't get access to an actual worldview. I don't think a lot of Americans know what people in China are thinking, what people in someplace like Kyrgyzstan. I mean, most folks can't find that on a map. And I don't know whether it's the fault of the American people or the fault of the American media, but it seems to me that we have a relatively closed worldview here, and that impedes our ability to help people around the world.
Well, the thing that I've realized, you know, especially in reaction to some of the simple and straightforward proposals that I'm making, I get, you know, slammed by the Wall Street Journal, for example. And then I realize that these people that are writing, they don't have a clue. They're sitting comfortable in Washington. They never go to a village abroad. They actually don't know at all what they're talking about. And then we appoint people or nominate people like Wolfowitz, who has no development experience at all. And so we propagate whatever myths we want, and that is what the American people tend to hear. And, you know, the American people are worried. I'm getting lots of email from the red state, so-called, saying, gosh, you know, I never heard anything like this. Where can I contribute $5 for a bed net? I want to help keep a child alive. Our church group wants to help adopt a village. This is terrible. You know, we never knew about it. So the fact of the matter is, you're absolutely right. The so-called Washington pundits, the ones who have portrayed the poor as corrupt, who portray Africa as corruption, 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 these people never even go. They actually don't know what they're talking about.
Okay, well, listen, Jeffrey Sachs, what I want to do when we come back, we're going to take a quick break. I'd like to just go down, a short list of what we should do, how we can do some of that, and, you know, and how other people can get involved.
Terrific.
And we'll do that when we come back. We're talking to Jeffrey Sachs. The book is The End of Poverty, Economic Possibilities for Our Time. It's 44 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition is more than just a commute companion. Listen online at morningsedition.com. Morning Sedition, on the air.
And online.
Listen at the office at morningsedition.com.
America Radio.
Work.
Forty-nine past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
We're going to land this thing. It's Monday. It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. On the phone with us right now is economist Jeffrey Sachs. His book, The End of Poverty, Economic Possibilities for Our Time, is available at morningsedition.com for the special Air America discount. Now, Jeffrey, we were going to talk about what can be done, what can people do.
First of all, there are a billion people that are fighting for survival right now. They're the ones in extreme poverty. The point of the book is that this kind of extreme poverty can be ended within our time, by our generation, by the year 2025. And that's, I think, what we ought to do if we want to really have a safer world and a decent world. Second, what does it take? The financial costs of doing this are so embarrassingly small that it's shocking. The point of the financing is that we have promised as a country to give 70 cents out of every $100 of our income in help for the poorest people in the world. 70 cents out of $100.
That's horrible.
7. But we're not doing it. We're not even coming close. And when I proposed that, the Wall Street Journal called it giving till it hurts. You know, I'm surprised that it hurts a Wall Street Journal reader 70 cents on the $100. I think we could afford this if we understand that at the other side of that 70 cents is a child who will otherwise die, people that are otherwise in misery of hunger, without access to schools, clean water, and we think this is going to make a safer world for us, somehow we found a way to give $5 out of every 100 for the military, but we're at 15 cents out of every $100 for development aid.
But and also, like, I guess people fail to realize is that, you know, if the poverty is dealt with and corrected, or at least, you know, people are set into motion to where they can start, you know, producing and using their resources on their own, is that you don't have climates, social climates where terrorism is fulminating. You don't have that type of despair and that type of anger.
That's exactly right, and that's what the CIA actually has been saying for years. That's even what the government says, but actually in Washington, A, they don't know what they're doing, and B, they don't know how to do arithmetic. Because even this year's budget says we have three pillars of national security. We have defense, which is a nice euphemism. We have diplomacy, and we have development. But then they spend 30 times more on the military than they do on development. And even a lot of the development's not really development. It's Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Turkey. It's not the poorest countries of the world. And so you have great instability. You have the Darfurs. You have hungry people fighting each other. We're not doing much, if anything, to help. And we could actually solve these problems. And Americans, because they do have values, because they do care, they just don't know, they would like to take this on. What would you do with the 70 cents? Very practical things. You could control malaria. You could get AIDS under control. You could get TB under control.
Unbelievable.
You could provide clean drinking water in villages. You could have meals for children in village schools so they'd actually go to school and be able to learn something. And that's what this small contribution would do if there weren't such obfuscation about it, and if President Bush would mention poverty at least one out of every 1,000 times he says the word freedom.
But now, Jeffrey Sachs, some people argue that doing what you're talking about will have the effect of propping up tyrannical regimes where large numbers of poor people end up living. What do you say to that?
Well, it's so ridiculous. What we're doing right now is spending huge amounts of money in the military, in places like that, but when you actually have a democracy like in Tanzania or like in Ghana or like in Senegal, where you actually have an impoverished country with a democracy, we don't even notice. And so it's exactly the opposite. I'm not calling for pumping money into tyrannical governments. I'm calling for putting money where you have good governance but poverty.
Right.
We're just blind to poverty in Washington. Why does he talk so much about freedom but doesn't mention the fact that people are dying by the thousands of poverty every day?
Because that might insinuate that there's a poverty problem in this country.
Well, no doubt it would. It might give that idea. That's right.
Yeah, and God forbid that happens, or that maybe that there's actually a class conflict in this country. He doesn't want to let that cat out of the bag.
Well, if it's true, if the Wall Street Journal thinks 70 cents on the $100 is giving till it hurts, we really have a serious problem here.
You know, hey, let me ask you another question, Jeffrey, because, you know, we all are familiar with organizations and groups that claim to do this type of work. Is there any way that we can get people active right now? And is there any groups or organizations that are working in affiliation with the government in a proactive way that you believe in?
Well, there are several. One thing, if people want to read about in more detail the things they can be done, because there are a lot of options, if they go to earthinstitute.columbia.edu/endofpoverty.
Wow, I'm going to have
sorry. earthinstitute.columbia.edu/endofpoverty. They can find out all different kinds of ways that they can help. They can donate $5 for a bed net. They can give money to the Global Fund to fight AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria. They can go to other NGOs that are doing very fine and good work where their money will get right down into villages. And they can tell that the president and the Congress that why are we not solving these problems that are otherwise going to keep us in danger?
Well, that's
what they should be telling our politicians in Washington.
Terrific. I'm glad that you gave us that information. We'll put that up on our website and make sure people can link to it. Jeffrey Sachs, very informative and very passionate. It was great to talk to you.
Thanks so much. Good to be with you.
Okay, you take care. The book is The End of Poverty, Economic Possibilities for Our Time. You know, he puts it into a real language where it's like, why can't we just do this? I mean, obviously, you know, there's plenty of reasons on behalf of the Republican agenda, you know, that they don't see the profits for corporate entities or for possibilities of control if everybody's actually, you know, making an effort to help.
You know, I've said it before and I'll say it again. Within the shadow of the new World Bank headquarters on 18th and Pennsylvania in Washington is a vest pocket park where the homeless of Washington gather every day.
Wow.
They don't notice one, they may not notice the others.
Oh, there's the liberal agenda from the Streisand compound. Write these down, folks. Here are your marching orders for today. 1, Lent is over. Since you probably didn't give up anything anyway, go on not giving it up. Like candy. Two, tell people that the final four refers to the remaining number of Tom DeLay's brain cells, though active they are. Three, praise the movie Guess Who as an amusing parable supporting both racial tolerance and recycling. Of the plot. Of the plot, people.
Yeah.
Four, no matter what happens today, blame either Florida or Texas. There's a good chance you'll be right. Five, today's phrase just dropped this into conversation. Hey, Bush, Iraq used to have a culture of life too, man. Where's their feeding tube? Huh? Wake up, sheeple. Light a candle for yourself. That's right, man.
Yeah, man.
What
now,
do you got?
We got a real quick piece of information. The Elevator Construction Union Local 1 here in New York City is over 10th Avenue and 34th Street in Manhattan. They want to make sure people know they are not striking. They've been locked out by building owners who have refused to negotiate with their union over a new contract.
Thanks for getting that in.
All right. Now, tomorrow, we're going to talk about Islam with author and scholar Reza Aslan. And he's got some very interesting views about the future of Islam and the future of fundamentalism.
Great.
But that's tomorrow. Marin, good to see you back.
Good to see you, man.
Morning Sedition.
On Air America Radio.